Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, most people have a sliding doors moment in their life. And for Susie Ronson, it was when she was working as a hairdresser in Beckenham and David Bowie's mum walked in for a shampoo and set. And from then on, things were never quite the same, as is detailed brilliantly in her wonderful book, Me and Mr. Jones. Susie, it's lovely to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Give us the full version of what happened that day. When was this, roughly?
It was 1971.
Yeah.
And she was just a regular woman. She looked a bit like my mum. You know, she had like a little cardigan on and she came in for her shampoo and set. And I did her hair for a few weeks before I realised who she was talking about. She talked to me about her son, David, and, oh, he was a wonderful musician. He sung in a band. And I would like to say, yeah, you know, I didn't think much of it. It wasn't until she mentioned, you know, Space Oddity.
Right.
Which had been out, a couple of years before, hadn't it?
Yes, it had been a couple of years before. So I was like, Space Oddity, I heard that on the radio. And that's when I realised that Mrs. Jones, I said, are you his mum? And she said, yes, she was his mum. And that was, I was surprised. But then I thought, well, a couple of years ago, he'd been playing folk music down the Three Towns. Might be a one-hit wonder. You know, I didn't really think.
Well, he'd had... The Man Who Sold the World had been out, had it?
He had, but it had no real critical acclaim.
That's right.
I certainly didn't know it. I mean, I knew, I was kind of a regular kid. I knew what was on Top of the Pops and Radio Luxembourg or the Pirate Radio.
But you'd seen him and Angie, I think, walking around Beckenham, hadn't you?
Afterwards, not till after that.
Oh, not till afterwards, okay.
I saw him, he was walking down Beckenham, I'd be wearing a dress, and he was with Angie. Everybody ran out to have a look. You were going, oh, look at that bloke with a dress. Richard. And some builders were calling across the street, oi, darling, you know, and all that. But
yeah.
So he had this long hair and a hat and everything. And I was curious about him, but I think everybody was curious about him. But it wasn't until I met him that he got very charismatic, David. So when you meet him, you're a bit like, ooh. Because he doesn't say much. I think really he was, he had Angie. Angie was like a very bubbly, effervescent girl. And she would chat. So David just kind of sit there and take it all in.
And it was through Angie that you met him, wasn't it? Because she then came into the shop for a perm or whatever.
She came into the shop. No, yeah. she wanted to have, I put some bright streaks in her hair.
Yeah.
What was the name of the hairdresser? Let's get
Evelyn Padgett.
Evelyn Padgett. Yeah.
It was a small concern. They had salons in Penge and Bromley and Petswell. They had salons around. I was in the Beckenham one, yeah.
Right.
So Angie came in. It was Christmas and she wanted a perm. Well, everybody's busy at Christmas. It's Christmas week. So I followed her outside and said I would come to her house to do her hair. And off I went to Haddon Hall. And that's when I met David.
So describe Haddon Hall, this legendary place.
Oh, it was stunning. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. It was an old Victorian place. So you walk in, It's like I've got a nice vestibule, you know, thing, double doors, and you walk in, and then there's this staircase that's like looks like something out of a Hollywood movie set, and stained glass windows at the back. It looked like a church to me. And then there was a little tiny pocket of a kitchen. I mean, the kitchen was minuscule and the bathroom wasn't a lot bigger, but the living, I wasn't looking at those at that particular time. But when I walked into the living room, it was not like my living room. I mean, it was huge, very tall ceilings, dark blue carpet, dark blue walls, not much furniture, coffee table full of magazines and album covers. Few musical instruments, you know, tape recorder, and David sitting in the bay window looking through magazines. That's the first time I saw him. Right. And then he said hello, and then they left the room. They left me there for like, I mean, it felt like hours, but it might have been 20 minutes. And I found out later they did this to quite a few people. They just said hello, and they walked out the room and left you there.
Expecting to discover what?
I think they wondered if people would leave or if they would stay. I don't know. It was one of their little games they used to play. Well, of course, I didn't leave. I was fascinated by all the album covers and the magazines, because these magazines from Europe, they were from Europe. They weren't English magazines. And right. The models looked different and the clothes looked different.
Which is where he got the idea, wasn't it, for the short haircut that you gave him. Didn't he see a model or something in a magazine?
Yeah, she was a Kansai Yamamoto model. And she was saying, you look great, you know, you look wonderful with short hair. And she asked me what I thought, and I said, well, no one's got short hair. You'd be the first. And he came over and he showed me this magazine, this photo in this magazine of this girl with this short, red, spiky hair. He said, can you do that? Well, as I'm saying yes, I'm thinking to myself, that's a girl's haircut. That was the first thing I thought. And how on earth am I going to do that? But, you know, inside I was really excited because he was perfect to do this haircut on. He was tall, rock star thin. He had this great face. If I could pull it off, it might look really good. Well, I cut it that night.
Sorry, go on. Carry on.
Okay. I cut it that night. I wouldn't stand up. I was curious. I was kind of cautiously optimistic. But then when I finished, it kind of just flopped.
Flopped.
I was like, geez, what am I going to do about that? And he wasn't very happy. And I didn't feel too good about it. But I said, David, the second we get some colour in your hair, the texture's going to change. It will stand up, I can promise. And I'm praying I'm right.
You're bluffing.
Praying I was bluffing. Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing. So I went and found the colour the next day in my salon, Red Hot Red by Schwarzkopf. I used it, one of the juniors here. And I went around a few days later and dyed it red. But it was the making it stand up that was a problem, because we didn't have fixatives in those days.
No.
We didn't have, you know, we might have had tippity-doo, but that wasn't going to do it, was it? Yeah. So I used this anti-dandruff treatment called Guard. I used to use it on the old girls at the salon. Side effect, it set hair like stone. So I used this Guard stuff and it stood up. And the second he saw himself in the mirror with the short red spiky hair, he was like, whoa. And he loved it. And that was my beginning of my time with David, yeah.
And the Spiders from Mars were there at the time, and he already had the band, didn't he, I think, by then?
He had the band, but they weren't there when I was doing his hair, but they had the band. I met them. I saw them play some college in London, and then I met them at Haddon Hall. That was the night when David kissed Freddie, and I was like, what's going on? That was a moment for me, because...
But you transformed the Spiders, didn't you? Because your next job was to give the three of the Spiders a kind of new look.
Rick Bronson didn't want me to touch his hair. He liked his hair as it was. But Woody was up for it, and Trevor's came out, I thought, one of the best, actually, because... Before I had him, he just had all one length dark hair. And when I spiked the top up, so it spiked up and it looked great, because he had really good hair, Trevor. I think it came out very well. Woody's hair looked okay, but it was really dry and frizzy. It was hard to do Woody's hair.
So this is really interesting. I love this book because it supports my theory that everything in pop music is about hair. It's all ultimately about hair. It's not about music at all. It's hugely important because, you know, at the point that you do this, 1971, nobody is doing anything with their hair other than growing it. basically. Exactly. That's what blokes did. They left school, and as soon as they left school, if they weren't working in a bank, they grew their hair. That was their expression, wasn't it, of kind of freedom?
Yeah, nobody had short. All the music people, I mean, Rolling Stones, everybody had long hair. So I said to him, you'd be the first, and he
And
it was such a different kind of a short haircut with the collar and, you know, sticking up like that. No one had that.
Right. So it was really, you know, when you were sitting down with these blokes, it was really a kind of statement, wasn't it, that they were making in having something done with their hair.
And plus, you know, costumes, makeup.
Yeah. No,
not sure. Not sure I was doing that either.
So what did Mick Ronson look like? So Mick Ronson's come from Hull. When he's contacted to be a member of the Spiders from Mars, I think he's marking up a school playing field, isn't he? He's just a bloke.
Yeah, he'd been to London before. He'd tried it. You know, starving on baked beans in London. Mick had tried before.
Right.
He got arrested, I think. He was in a band and he came back from Europe. And he was the driver. He's a lousy driver, Mick. And he was driving around Hyde Park Corner and...
Not a good idea at the best of times.
Pretty taxing, yeah.
He driving around Hyde Park Corner and they stopped him and he had no driving licence and no insurance.
They were going to
arrest him, right? And the rest of the band just got out the band and ran away and left him there with this truck.
Very, very mature.
Exactly.
Really,
so I think after that he was like, he was done. He went back to Hull.
Right.
And then sure enough, I don't know how long it was after that before David got him, but it was a few months at least, because his dad wanted him to work at the BP factory alongside him.
But
what did your parents think about you hanging out at Haddon Hall? Because you were living with your mum and dad at the time, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I was.
And then eventually they see Bowie on the cover of, I think, the Melody Maker with your haircut, which must have been...
Right. Well, that's not what interested them. It was the fact he said, I'm gay and I always have been. That's what was interesting my mum.
Yeah.
She was like, are you working for a puff? And I'm like, oh, no. I said, no. And I said, it's just for the papers, Mum. You know, he's married. He's got a child. He can't be. And my dad wasn't too happy. My brother's going, oh, you know, it's just like all that. And I was a bit nervous, but she never tried to stop me. And I'm eternally grateful for that, because she could have made life a lot more difficult, but she didn't. So I was really grateful for her not doing that.
Right.
And also David, the gay thing, I mean. He'd horse around with his friends at the house, and they'd kind of play around, and there was a lot of innuendo. But in reality, David never acted like a gay man. He never looked like, he didn't lisp or mince or none of that. He was like a bloke.
And and Angie told you that they had an open marriage, didn't they? So that must have been pretty extraordinary at the time.
Yeah. Well, Angie was, you know, she was with Mickey Finn from T-Rex. She's telling me about this as she's in the bath. Well, I mean, David and T-Rex, they were kind of a bit, David and Mark were friends, but they were also fierce competitors. And for her to be sleeping with Mickey Finn, I kind of thought she was a bit like sleeping with the enemy. I didn't really approve, you know what I'm saying? Could have picked somebody else kind of thing.
All right.
Yeah. But it was so unusual, wasn't it? Because at that time, you talk about seeing, you know, Freddie Beretti was there, kind of working on the costumes, and Mick Rock, the photographer, and Lindsay Kemp and everybody. And, you know, I suppose at that time, a lot of what musicians did was orchestrated by a manager or stylist or whatever. But all this was of his own devising, wasn't it, really? He assembled these people around him.
Yeah, Tony DeFries did give David the opportunity and the money. He found the money for David to do whatever he wanted to do. He could never have done that Rainbow Theatre thing, that extravaganza, if he hadn't had Tony in the background supplying the cash.
Yeah.
That's how would he have done it, you know? And David just, I mean, Tony just let David do whatever he wanted to do, but what David wanted to do was incredible. I mean, he had fantastic vision. He really did. Fantastic vision.
Do you think he knew what he was going to do, or was he kind of making it up as he went along?
No, I think he knew what he was going to do.
Right.
Especially the Rainbow Show. He knew what he was doing. I was with them when they were, you know, we took that Rainbow Theatre over for a few days. The scaffolding, and they had to have planned all that. He had to have planned all that. There was never a moment, oh, should we do this? No. David knew what was going on. Right. Him and Lindsay, yeah.
How did it feel to see those audiences eventually start to adopt what was effectively your haircut, the one that you'd invented? It must have been an amazing thing.
Yeah. It was incredibly exciting. Incredibly exciting. It was, yeah. That's all I can say, really. It was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me, meeting David and Angie. I mean, I never knew people like David and Angie existed. I didn't. I was suburban. I'd been to Italy for nearly a year trying to find something exciting to do. I went to the States to visit my cousin in Pennsylvania. But I'd been looking for a long time. I did not want to live the life of my parents. I'd been looking for a long time. And when I met David, I realised this was it. This was it. Mm. So my mother said after she read the paper, she said, "Oh, at least we know it won't be after you then, Susie." And I thought that was funny.
Did you go about the costumes? Because you and Angie go out shopping in places like Liberty's and Mr. Fish stuff, don't you?
Yes.
So did David give you some indications of the kind of things he wanted you to buy, or was that broadly up to you?
That day I went shopping with Angie, Tony had asked me to take her away because she was distracting David. And it was her and Freddie, really. And David, the three of them designed those costumes, but Angie was the one that went and got them fabric. And we went to Liberty's. I'd never been to Liberty's before. It was incredible. That shop, I mean, it doesn't look like that now because I went in there at Christmas. It doesn't look like that now. But it was like very oldie worldy England. Yeah. And she obviously knew the guy in the fabric department. He was showing all these bolts of metallic fabric. And she was picking them. So I think it was between the three of them they did the designs. But I'm sure David had a lot to do with it. David had his finger on everything. You just didn't hear him say much.
So you were then employed by Main Man, weren't you? Your Main Man then gave you a full-time job and you left the hairdressers and joined the travelling circus.
That's what I did. It was the most wonderful day of my life, I think. I went up to see the manager. I was a bit nervous when I saw the manager because he was in his dressing gown. It was like 3 p.m. and he was in his dressing room. I'm thinking, shit, you're not going to sleep with the bloody manager. I wanted the job, but Tony DeFries, well, that's the other thing. Wasn't the most attractive
man. We're in a 60s movie now, aren't we?
Wasn't the most attractive man in the world. But then when I walked in, his girlfriend came down the stairs, Melanie. So I immediately felt better. But I'd never met anyone like Tony either. The confidence that he excluded with, the confidence was just beyond. He told me David was going to be a huge star and that they're going to bang down the doors to get him to America next year. Supremely confident. And he's got a voice like a doctor. You believe everything he says, you know, or a lawyer.
And he wanted to make Bowie kind of unreachable and mysterious, right, didn't he? So how did he go about doing that?
No press. No press unless it was organised from Main Man. No photographs, not a photograph. And he even bought up all David's old catalogue and stuff at that particular time. So no one could release anything else. I mean, I think he missed the laughing gnome, didn't he?
Somebody did.
At some point, I think that came out. But it was just really, he wanted to make David unworldly, unreachable. And everything was very controlled. He said if someone was seen with a camera in the audience, you'd throw him out, or a recording of him, to throw him out. And he just seemed delighted at it. He seemed thrilled that we could do that. And they had big signs in the lobbies, no recording equipment, no cameras. No one was doing stuff like that. It was really, go see the band, they get up from the bar and play a gig, you know, but
no,
it wasn't
true.
David and the Spiders. It wasn't.
So how did it feel to you to be on the inside of this? Was it very thrilling?
Yes, completely thrilling. It was the best, you know. Right from the rainbow, you know, I'd walk in and we were told, don't talk to the press outside, you know. Don't let them have any photographs. Don't tell them anything. This is a big secret. So I'd walk past them like, you know, like I was involved in it and I had my stage pass and no one else could come in. And yes, it felt really good.
Do you have a title? Did you have a job title?
Hairdresser, costume mistress, really.
Right.
I mean, it was divisions. There was a sound department, light department, and costumes and hair, and that was me.
Right. So would you turn up with a kind of, you know, a chest full of costumes?
Well, it travelled with the band, my chests. I mean, at first, they were just cases. and why you'd carry them. I can't remember exactly. I think they came in with the equipment, but eventually Tony got me wardrobe trunks.
Right.
Big, beautiful wardrobe trunks. And they'd just come in with the equipment, yeah.
And would there be choices of what to wear in the
band, for the band? For David, there was many choices, but for the band, but there wasn't at first, to be honest. There wasn't at first. Because he didn't change costume as much as he eventually did. When we got the Japanese costumes, that's when he was, like, changing costumes all the time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But the band would change costumes once. We'd have a silver set for the first set and then a gold set for the second.
Right.
So I'd like two sets of costumes for each band. The trouble is, when we got busy and we did matinees, we'd have to iron the sweat out the costumes.
Yeah, I guess. There can't be a lot of opportunities for laundry in these kind of...
Exactly. And you couldn't launder them. You'd have to dry clean them. Yeah. And I was always terrified, especially as David got more famous, that they would disappear or something.
Yeah.
Imagine I'd have died. It would have been dreadful. It would have been really dreadful.
So were you the first kind of music stylist, would you say that?
I think I was.
I think you were.
Say I was kind of the first girl.
We're going to say you were.
We were going to say.
That sounds good. No, I was the first music. Because I never met another girl on the road that was working like I was. I mean, there was plenty of girls on the road, but they weren't working.
No.
I loved working, the working part of it, being involved in the show. I loved that.
But it's amazing because nowadays it's a huge industry, isn't it?
You know, yes.
There isn't a band in the world that doesn't have a stylist.
That has a stylist designing all the costumes and the hair advice.
Yeah, it's true, but when there wasn't back then. And when I look back at how we did it, on a shoestring, not money-wise, yeah. But everything we did was no one had done it before. No one had had costumes before. No one had a hairdresser on the road before, dyed your hair. Folks weren't really dyeing their hair. It was a much more that, I mean, David ushered in that whole glam glitter. And then meeting people like Lou Reed and Iggy Pop. Lou Reed was a revelation.
Go on. In what way?
I met him. I was doing that Save the Whale concert at the Royal Festival Hall. He did right after he did Starman on Top of the Pops. We did the Royal Festival Hall and I was there looking after Lou. Well, I thought Lou was a big star in the States. The way David and Angie used to talk about him, I thought he was a big star in the States, but he wasn't like that. He looked terrified. He's walking around backstage, very white, sweaty, nervous. And I said, are you all right? He said, well, how many people out there? I said, I think about 2,000. You know, we sold out. Well, he looked at me. I mean, if I told David and the Spiders had sold out, they were in raptures, you know, but Lou didn't look like that. He looked terrified.
Right.
And the gig came out really well. I took him to the side of the stage. Mick started that throbbing riff of I'm Waiting for the Man. And Lou steps on and the crowd goes crazy. It was a great gig. Lou all rock and roll darkness and the band all glam and glitter. It was a great gig. one of the best yet.
And then I got the impression that the American audiences were slightly different reaction, because the British audience were much quicker at adopting the whole extravagance of what Bowie's act was doing. Whereas in America, you go to places and it's kind of Bible Belt, isn't it? You know, and they're a little bit more reserved. Would that be true? Is it? Did he not?
Completely true. And I think it's got a lot to do with geography. I mean, England's a small country.
Yeah.
Cars gets around, even in those days before the whatever, the NME, the Melody Maker, the Record Mirror, whatever it was, there was one more. But you'd hear about it from town to town. So I think and fans would travel from town to town, can you imagine? But they used to. And in America, it's so vast. And yes, the Bible Belt. That was not a good place for us to play. Can you imagine David playing in Texas? We never played Texas.
So had the press caught up to what had they caught up with what he was trying to do, or do you feel they were a bit behind the beat?
Completely behind the beat. I mean, not on the coasts or in the big cities, and places like Cleveland loved him, but and even Memphis loved him, which I was surprised about. But we didn't do any of those real deep south places. We did Florida, actually, did very well in Florida, but the rest of it, no, we left that alone.
Tell us about the importance of Mick Ronson to David Bowie.
Oh, where do I start?
Wherever you like.
I mean, when you... Ken Scott wrote a book, and he put in there about Mick. So did I mention that Mick Ronson... We could never have done this without Mick Ronson. He was major, and shall I again say major part of David's albums. So we could never have done albums like that without Mick. And apart from that, David would not have been the same David on stage without Mick. Mick was half of David on stage and in the studio. And that's not just because I married him. I mean, I saw it. Everybody knew it, except Mick, it seemed, you know. Mick didn't realise how good he was, I don't think. But he'd step out and do that Moonage Daydream solo. And I wish they'd filmed him more. David, Tony was always saying, film Mick, film. Tony would always say, film David, and he would not have the camera on Mick at all. But Mick was dynamite on stage. Have you seen it? Did you ever see any of those shows?
Yeah, well, I've seen film of them. No.
Yeah. You'd see him live, width of a circle, when David's changing his costume. Mick Ronson with his guitar above his head. And of course, he was gorgeous. I mean, that was the other thing. I think there were more girls after Mick than there were after David, in actual fact. I think they knew. Then you were getting with Mick, you know. David had this little mystery about him.
But so Mick didn't realise this himself, didn't realise.
I don't think he realised how important he was to David, no. Remember, he was a school gardener from Hull. He was from Hull. Mick's dad didn't have shoes on his feet till he was 13. So Mick came from quite a poverty-stricken background. Poverty-stricken, that's not nice to say. His family were great. His mum and his dad and his sister and his brother, fabulous people. But they had no money, you know. They lived on a council estate in Hull, Greatfield Estate. And so to him, as to me, when you see this extravagance and what's going on, you're a bit taken aback.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did he react to all that? Him particularly, because when the Main Man tour went to America, didn't they overspend something like $250,000 or something? And there was... unbelievable. Everyone was told they had to stop, you know, spending, basically.
By the time we got to California, we were told we had to stop spending. I didn't actually... I itemised every penny I spent down to my last dime, because one of the girls in the Main Man offices, who I'm still friends with, Maxine Marshall, she, I think I've still got some of your expense sheets, because I just wanted to be, you know, so honest, because I was, you know, wanted to stay in my job. But the rest of them, my God... I never seen money spent like that. My mum and dad would have had a fit. And Mick just went along with it all, as you do. It wasn't, we stayed. But the other thing was, De Vries hired people that had never done it before. He didn't hire people that were used to being on the road. So we all kind of thought this was a normal way to travel. Beverly Hills Hotel in California, Plaza in New York. We all thought that was quite normal. I mean, I thought everybody did this. Never thought we were special. I thought everybody travelled like this. This is what rock and roll's all about. Isn't it great, you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't on a leaky bus and dragging my ass around England, no. I was on a fabulous bus having a really good time.
So was it a great shock to Mick when Bowie decided that's the end of Spinal Tap?
We both knew. We heard it in Japan. We both knew. But
Tony told you and Mick, didn't he? But he didn't tell Woody and Trevor.
He was talking He was talking to David and Mick.
All right.
He didn't tell Trevor. No, they didn't tell Trevor or Woody, which I thought was criminal, really, a dreadful thing.
It puts you in a difficult position too, because you knew then, didn't you?
I kept hoping he would change his mind. I don't think Tony really meant to say it in front of me, because when he realised I was there, you know, you're kind of serving a bit of coffee and in the background. He said, you'll have another job. Because I didn't want to go back to Beckenham, did I? No. He said, if you keep quiet, I'll make sure you keep working with us. So I felt awful. I thought David must tell them, or Mick would tell them. And then they promised Mick that he was going to be the next main man superstar. Well, David made it look so easy.
Yes.
So I think Mick thought, okay. All right, then I'll do that.
Because you're right about that. He has his first solo album. It comes out on RCA. It's Main Man. You know, he gets the treatment. And then nothing happens with it, really, does it?
Well, I mean, it was completely unfair. Mick should have been given time off to find his own way. You know, he should have done some production. He should have done something that he was really good at. But to throw him out there, and then Tony says to us, before the first show, we went to the office and Tony said, oh, I've hired the London Philharmonic Orchestra to do your first shows with you. Well, Mick was just trying to put a band together, trying to gather himself, he's just done the record, and now he's got the London Philharmonic Orchestra he's got to write parts for. I mean, a poor lad. I didn't know how to help him. Mm. And David wasn't around. I really thought, and this is how naive I was, I really thought that David was going to help Mick make his record. I thought he was going to help Mick, you know, like Mick helped him. I thought that's what was going to go on. But we never saw David.
David was kind of off on another trajectory. It wasn't entirely about him. Yeah.
And also, I believe at that point he was in his defence. I think at that point he had this severe flirtation with cocaine, which, if you know what cocaine's like, it kind of makes you very single-minded. And he was doing Diamond Dogs.
It must have been so hard for Mick, because some of those reviews, I was looking at the reviews of those early records, they were kind of saying Bowie without the Bowie and things like that. I mean, that's
what it was, though. And we also... David made it look so easy. David changed completely. He just went being lost at Ziggy Stardust stuff. And we did the, you know, Pin-Ups album. We did the Wardour Street, a 1980 floor show. And that was it for David. He wasn't going to do that anymore. And he knew how to change. Or he surrounded himself with people that knew how to change him. We didn't know how to do that.
Maybe so did you feel him becoming a bit more distant?
I never saw him. My distant. Yeah. We never saw him. Never heard from him. Didn't know what to do. We both floundered around, really, trying to make it work. And then we realised kind of that glam was over. We should have known that. Because out there with his costume, you know, and it was David without David, yes, and it wasn't good. I mean, it was good. Good music. Mick was great. But it wasn't groundbreaking. It was nothing new.
The other band experience that you write about in this book is the Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder tour, which Mick was part of.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was a great tour. I mean, that was the first time. That was a tour like a Bowie tour, because there was tons and tons of people. We stayed in the best hotels. I didn't go on the first part of it. I went on the second part. And Bob is another one. You see him, the charisma is just like... And you wouldn't think about it when you look at a photograph of him, would you? I mean, he's like a skinny bloke.
Yeah, you talk about him being so magnetic. Can you describe what it was about him that was...
I wish I could. You know, people have either got it or they haven't. When you're in the presence of someone and they just take out a guitar and you're like, you know, you can't stop looking at them and you can't believe what you're hearing. And I don't know the difference between that. It's just different. And I don't think it's anything you can really put your finger on. I mean, Elvis Presley had it, David had it, Dylan had it in spades. My God. And sometimes he was dreadful. Some gigs he was dreadful. But other gigs, you could hear a penny drop in a 50,000-seater hall, and there's just him and a guitar without even a band.
The kind of random, spontaneous way that Dylan operates is incredible, because Mick got the job by being in a bar, didn't he? Where Dylan was playing and he kind of invited him up. Just tell us that story.
Well, we'd just gone through that whole Ian Hunter debacle and we weren't going to be working with Ian anymore. So
Mick was briefly a member of Motley Hoople. Yeah.
Member of Motley Hoople, and then Mick and Ian did a solo record for Ian, and it was a great record. Ian Hunter, it was called. But De Vries, our manager, so I don't like Fred, I don't like Ian Hunter, I don't like Fred Eller. That was Ian's manager. And you're not working with him anymore. Go live in New York. And he got us his flat in New York, the old Mayman offices. So we got to New York. And then Ian Corsi said, Bob Dylan's in town. Ian's a massive Bob Dylan fan. Come down to the other end, the Bitter End, I think it was called, on Bleecker Street. So he went down there. And we're just sitting there discussing managers and whatnot. And in walks Bob Dylan with a guitar and two or three friends. And he sits at a table like, not 6 feet from where we're sitting, whips out a guitar and plays the whole Desire album. Now, Mick and I are not Dylan fans. Mick used to say Bob Dylan sounded like Yogi Bear. We're not Bob Dylan fans, but, man, you just were like, whoa. He was incredible, the way he was dipping and swaying. And his voice, like no other voice I've ever heard. But somehow it works, you know. And then, yeah, later that night, I talked to Bobby Newirth, who was a friend of Dylan's. And I told him I was here with, you know, Mick Ronson and Ian Hunter. He didn't really know who they were till I mentioned David Bowie and all the young dudes. And at some point, he played for drinks. Bobby Newirth was playing for drinks. Because the owner of the club, Paul Colby, said, oh, I can't play another band. You know, I've got to play in a band. So he would play for drinks. So when they got on stage, he ordered a bottle of tequila to come to the stage. So the whole band had a swig, Mick included. Now, Mick wasn't up there yet, but the whole band. Then he passed it out to the audience. All the audience had a drink of this tequila. And then halfway through the night, he said he wanted more tequila and is there a spider in the house? And everyone's looking around and Mick's looking at me and I'm like, go on up there. So they get him up there. Well, of course, Mick's glorious playing. He doesn't know any of the songs, doesn't matter. What he's playing sounds stunning. And that was the night he was asked to join Rolling Thunder Review. What a great tour that was.
Well, when he came back from the tour, he got a bill from the...
That's right.
Yeah.
He hadn't earned any money.
He got an invoice, not wages, didn't he? That's right.
Tony De Vries called us to the offices. Now, yeah. I don't know about Mick on this, because Mick can act like he's a bit of a fool, but he's not, you know. Now, we knew we weren't going to see a dime off this money, because, of course, we owe De Vries the world, we owe him everything. And the only person that was going to see the money was Tony. Well, Mick likes a few drinks. And when he has a few drinks, he gambles. And he's a shit gambler when he drinks. He can't gamble. So, yes, at the end of that tour, we got a bill instead of some wages. That was a shocking moment for all of us. Mick's going, oh, I don't know, Tony, I don't know how that happened. I'm looking at him, what do you mean you don't know how it happened? He said, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry, Tony. I just don't know. And I'm laughing. I said, Mick. And he said, oh, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, that was the end of kind of Tony, I think, was giving up on Mick after that one.
Right. There's a really interesting bit where you talk about going on that second part of the tour and you're saying it's very hard to integrate with everybody on a tour, which I can really understand when you're the rock star's wife or girlfriend or whatever, or husband or whatever. It must be very hard to fit in. You felt sort of a bit outside it all.
Well, first of all, I hadn't been on the first part of the tour. Mick had told me girls weren't on that part of the tour. Liar, big fat bibber. They were all on that tour. And they were all, these were Americans. I mean, American, if you like. From all over, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Kinky Friedman. These people were musicians I'd never heard of. And their lifestyle was something I didn't know about, really. I'd traveled in America with David, but I hadn't traveled with American musicians. And Americans are really different to Europeans. They are. And they were even more so then, I think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was something I'd never experienced before.
Very early on, you're going out with, in the book, you're going out with the drummer of Chicken Shack. And yes. I remember he goes off, suddenly just leaves you and goes off on a tour of Europe or something. And you said, at that point, I realised that, you know, being, you know, with a musician was going to be quite hard.
Well, horrible. That's why I never wanted to be. I mean, on the Rolling Thunder Review, it was the first time I was suddenly the wife.
Yeah,
I didn't have a job on that tour. And I much preferred it, having a job. It was your own person then. But just hanging out with your boyfriend and go, oh, what are you doing? And would you like to, you've got a clean pair of socks, you know? That really wasn't my scene.
Yeah.
To be fair, Mick didn't really treat me like that, but that's the way it was. You felt on the outside looking in rather than being part of it. I much prefer being part of it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, look, so there it is. It's all in Me and Mr. Jones.
You've got the book and I haven't even seen
that. Oh, you've got the book. Oh, yes.
Oh, well, I haven't seen that yet.
It's proof.
Proof copies, yeah.
Proof copy, yeah. So,
I did,
yeah.
Didn't Faber do a great job, I have to say.
It's good.
Very
it's
good.
It's lovely. That's my Mick Rock's photo, bless him.
Yeah, it's lovely. That's a fantastic book. You learn a great deal about Bowie and about that whole world of that time.
And, yes, it was. Well, I thought to myself, you know, everyone's written about David. Everyone knows every bloody note he played. But it's different when you're seeing it from my side of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Starts with the hair. It's all about the hair. I'm sorry. Everything comes from the hair. It really does.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.